John Friend. All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. The website is therealistreport.com, where you can find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other radio programs I've participated in over the years. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded on the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to the Barnes Review, the bi-monthly history magazine affiliated with American Free Press. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications if you do not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all of the details. All right, with that said, let me introduce my special guest today. Dr. Kevin McDonald of the Occidental Observer is back once again. Dr. McDonald and I have a lot to discuss today, so let's jump right into it. Dr. McDonald, welcome back to the program. It's always an honor to have you here.
Hey, John. It's great to be here.
Yes, sir. Yeah, there's lots going on, and I know you've been very busy. I just listened to a program you did with Red Eyes TV with Angelo John Gage, and you guys were kind of focusing on the situation in Syria, the really disgraceful and totally unnecessary situation in Syria, our recent airstrike over there. I do plan on talking about that with you, but I wanted to start off by talking about all this controversy that's come up of late with people actually addressing your work, something that hasn't really happened in the past.
That's new.
Yeah. I mean, people that are, you know, listening to this program, I'm sure are familiar with your work. You've been on this program a number of times, and we've discussed your work and many of your articles and your books at length. But lately, there's been actually a couple Jewish, well, I know one Jewish journalist, another, I believe he's a student at Oxford University over in England. He wrote a critical review of your trilogy, the Culture of Critique trilogy. And basically, I've heard some people claim that, you know, this is a devastating blow to your work. And I read his original paper. I haven't read all of the responses back and forth, but I've heard you on YouTube talking with Luke Ford, you know, kind of debating these issues. And I did read Koffness's original review of your work, and I don't see how he's really debunked any of the main points that you're making. So let's start off, you know, discussing this. And again, very few people paid any attention to your work. It was basically ignored or dismissed as, you know, this anti-Semitic conspiracy theorist, like crazy professor that's making up this stuff about Jews, right? I mean, that's pretty much the way it was treated. But again, there have been some responses lately. What explains that? Why all of a sudden are people like Abraham Miller, who wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal criticizing your work? Why is a guy like Abraham Miller and this Koffness guy, why are they all of a sudden interested in what you have to say and interested in attempting to debunk, you know, all the points that you're making?
Well, I think that what happened after the publication of the book was that it was ignored, and it was intentionally ignored. You know, there were a couple of controversies in 2000. Steven Pinker was asked about it on Slate, and he said, you know, it doesn't rise to the threshold of academic interest or something. And so he hadn't read it. And that was sort of the stance that people took, you know, that it wasn't necessary to even read it. It was just so obviously wrong. But then what happened was that it started to get influential, and people, especially people on the alt-right and, you know, similar kinds of, beliefs, began to, you know, cite this and use it, and think of Jews as not entirely just victims of history or something, and think of them as actors and players and people who really have different interests, they have a, you know, a very different vision of what America should be like than people on the alt-right do, and that they've been very influential in producing that vision of America. And so it became influential. And I think at some point they sort of decided, because this guy Koufness was actually consulting with Steven Pinker about this. Everybody knows Steven Pinker. You know, he's like a big public intellectual at Harvard University. And I think the idea was that somebody had to do something about this.
Right.
And so
right.
That produced Koufness's article in Human Nature. And then Abraham Miller, I hadn't heard of him. He's a political scientist, I think, at the University of Cincinnati or someplace. And he wrote a relatively short op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. But I don't think that any of those criticisms changed the points of view that people who had already liked culture critique. On the other hand, people who did not like, you know, who really don't want to even deal with that issue or think Jews are just wonderful and they have no influence or their influence is entirely benign or it's just that they're really smart or something. Those people, have latched onto that, I guess. I haven't seen much about that, but, any kind of pretext, any excuse, people tend to believe what they, things that fit with their other beliefs. So if you think Jews are just wonderful, then you're going to like what Koufness and Abraham Miller say.
Right, exactly. Well, and I think one of the main points in Koufness, and by the way, the guy's name is Nathan Koufness. I will have a link directly to his paper where you can read the entire thing. The title of it is Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy, a Critical Analysis of Kevin MacDonald's Theory. And you can sit down and read it in probably an hour or so. I mean, it didn't take me all that long. I think the version that I'm looking at, it's just right on the, it's Springer Link is the website apparently. I think it's like 23 total pages, so it's you could sit down and read it in like an hour or whatever. It's not that difficult to get through. And it's funny because one of the main points he makes right at the very beginning is that he's doing this because your work has been so influential in the alt-right has gained a lot of traction over the course of the past couple of years. And really, this is not, it kind of gets into Trump, but I think really that's the main thing with Trump for me is not that I think he had the potential to be this very revolutionary figure, this populist, build a wall, deport illegals, put America first, get out of the Middle East, all this stuff. He had the potential to do that. We're seeing that he's not really, following through with any of that, which is very unfortunate. But at the end of the day, I think it's very clear that his candidacy and now his presidency has facilitated the rise of the alt-right. And I think the alt-right has done a very good job of seizing this moment, getting our ideas out there. And a number of different individuals and organizations and, websites, et cetera, groups are playing a role in this. It's not just one person or one individual or one group. It's sort of the broader alt-right movement has done a good job of inserting itself into the political discourse. And that, to me, is a huge success. I mean, that alone, is really the main thing that I think Trump has done for us. And guys like Koufness and these other Jews, they clearly recognize this. And that's why, he wants to go out here and attempt to debunk your work.
Yeah, I think that's right. And by the way, I of course, replied to Koufness, very, very lengthy replied. And he commented on my reply negatively. And I commented on that. So if you go to Twitter, the pinned tweet that I have has all those replies and also what I said about Abraham Miller's op-ed. And in those replies, you can just click on the thing to get the Koufness's original comments.
Right.
So if you're really interested in pursuing this, this is not easy. The first reply, I think, was over 18,000 words, and the second reply was over 20,000 words. So this is not something you can knock off in an hour, but it is tedious because it's a tedious thing. But I decided I wanted to go through every last thing he said and to show that there was really nothing that he brought up that was really a problem at all.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, that was my reading of it. Again, I didn't read your response and the subsequent responses. I basically just read his original paper, and I think you're right. Yeah, I mean, I don't think he really damages your main thesis. And you know what? Let's actually start there, because my understanding, you know, like reading your work, it really just connected all the dots in my mind. It was basically stuff I sort of recognized and understood, but I just never, you know, had it all put together so concisely and so clearly. And, you know, I didn't have the historical foundation that you put together, because you see it. I mean, you can just, if you follow the, like the Jewish press, and if you follow like the ADL and some of these explicitly Jewish organizations, they openly tell us what they're doing and how anti-white they are and how they want to, for example, you know, grant amnesty to millions of illegal aliens and just open our borders to the third world, and how they're behind homosexuality and transgenderism, all this stuff. They openly admit it. And I was seeing this, and I, you know, I read your book, and it's like, oh wow, this all makes much more sense now. I got a, you know, a better, firmer understanding of how this all happened, you know, the historical nature of it, all that. So like your main thesis, from what I understand, is that the Jewish groups and movements and individuals that you discuss it throughout the trilogy, they were driven and motivated primarily by their Jewish identity, by their Jewish ethnicity, and they advanced policies and ideas that were designed to really attack and kind of undermine traditional Western civilization, all of which was aimed at, you know, subverting our nations, in order to, quote-unquote, end anti-Semitism and, you know, criticizing Jews, to basically make our country safe for the Jewish exploitation of it. That's really my understanding of your thesis. Do I have anything wrong there? I wanted to kind of start and maybe you could even, you know, describe your thesis better than I could.
Well, that's basically it. I mean, what I did in Culture Critique was to, in each of those chapters, I tried to show, and I think I did show, that the main figures strongly identified as Jews, and that they saw their work as advancing Jewish interests in some way. The most common interest that was, you know, that you can see throughout the book was combating anti-Semitism. You know, if you look at psychoanalysis, it produced all these theories in which anti-Semitism was completely unrelated to anything that any Jewish behavior. And you can see that in the Frankfurt School chapter, in the chapter on Franz Boas and anthropology. He was also very concerned about anti-Semitism. He did not like the idea current at the time that the European cultures were at sort of the pinnacle of human development. And so he got this whole idea of cultural relativism to combat that. He was very much into the idea of criticizing Western culture. His students were also, and most of his students were Jewish. So the point is, though, that Jewish identity and Jewish networking produced these movements, which were very influential in the academic world. I mean, Franz Boas basically took over anthropology. Psychoanalysis was the most common, popular theory for like 50, 60 years. It's still there. I mean, there's still some sort of nutcases that subscribe to it. And the Frankfurt School has led to postmodernism and all these other theories in the humanities and social sciences now that are just absolutely poisonous. But and then I had a chapter on immigration. And what was really noticeable about this whole thing is that Kufnis never really disputes that I was right about these things. What he tends to say is that, well, he points to some Jewish intellectuals who did not have these beliefs, like, say Chomsky. You know, Chomsky's been very critical of Israel. Kufnis basically has this idea that all Jews must be strong Zionists or else they're not really Jews or something like that. And what I try to do is talk about specific movements. I don't talk about fringe people. I don't talk about things that are not part of these movements. So I talk about Boasian anthropology. If Kufnis might come up with some anthropologist who's not Boasian, you know, who has other points of view, like, for example, Herrnstein, the co-author of The Bell Curve, might be someone like that. But the point is, what I'm trying to do is show that the successful movements, the specific movements that did have power and had a big influence, these essentially involved Jews at the very, you know, at the backbone of those movements, at the very center of them. And, you know, with all this network, this, you know, ethnic networking and so on, made them into very powerful movements. I'm not saying that all Jews believe X and that, or that all Jews must be Zionists or they're not really Jews or something. I mean, he's got some very confused points in there. But anyway, the point is that, I'm going after specific movements. And when in the chapter on immigration, he doesn't even try to show that these Jewish organizations were not pivotal in producing the 1965 immigration law, and that they still, there's not one Jewish organization. And I probably count the on one hand, the number of Jews who opposed this open borders policy, you know, and these, the ones who oppose it are not influential. People like Steven Steinlein. They're not influential. They, you know, even though they criticize the Jewish community on the grounds that Muslim immigration is bad for the Jews and all that, they don't have any influence. If you look at what the ADL is doing, what all the other Jewish organizations are advocating, they want open borders, and they always have. There's not one Jewish organization of any importance that wants some kind of restrictive immigration policy or even a merit-based immigration policy. They want to bring uneducated people they can find and bring them in there, and that's the America they want to see.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I'm getting some feedback. Okay, seems to be a little bit better. Yeah, no, that's exactly right, and that seems to be what Kaufness is really trying to do. He, you know, for you said Noam Chomsky. You know, he points to Noam Chomsky as being like this dissident Jew that doesn't go along with all this stuff, or at least parts of it, and is trying to use that to like undermine your whole thesis, which really is laughable when you stop and think about it. But you're right. I mean, I think especially with immigration, you know, the historical basis of it, you know, the push for open borders, it was, again, I mean, the organized Jewish community and individual Jews themselves in the Congress played a key role. Now, that's not to say that there weren't non-Jews involved with it or that didn't vote for it or et cetera, but the driving force behind it was this Jewish agenda. It's very clear. Right. I think you prove that. And I think we can prove that to this very day. It's still going on today.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing to me that's so important about your work is everything that you wrote about and demonstrated, you know, from a historical basis, we still see it today. Again, just by following Jewish organizations, the Jewish press, they admit this stuff. That's what's so incredible to me is that they try to paint us as these irrational, you know, conspiracy theorists that just irrationally hate Jews. When, you know, we're literally like quoting the ADL, and you do that at length in your book. I mean, you're quoting Jews, you're citing their press releases, citing their own policy papers to make all your points.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's really kind of, oh my gosh, it's really incredible when you stop and think about it. I still can't get over it. You know, I've been covering like the explicitly Jewish news for a very long time on my website, and it is incredible what they themselves openly say. They make all of our points for us. and then just dismiss us as, you know, hysterical anti-Semites, you know, neo-Nazis, etc. It's insane. Getting back
it's
to
sort of on autopilot, but you know, whenever there's some kind of issue involving refugees or immigration policy, you will see articles in the Forward or, you know, JTA, the Jewish Telegraph Agency, or whatever, and they will, you know, have, you know, talk about letters signed by 1,000 rabbis in favor of generous refugee policies, in favor of immigration. And you know, it's amazing how Jews, when they talk about refugee policy, say, it's always in terms of Jewish history. They'll say, well, what about the St. Louis? This happened in the 1930s, where a ship called the St. Louis couldn't dock in the United States. They were bringing refugees from Europe. And so from the Jewish point of view, it's always about Jews. What's good for Jews? It's never good about what's good for the United States or anybody else or our fellow citizens. It's always what's good for Jews. And so there's a real Jewish consensus on that issue, on immigration. Again, not all Jews, but when you look at where the power is, where the organized Jewish community is, where the Jewish money is, that's where it is. and it's very powerful. I mean, you look at AIPAC, you look at the Israel lobby. You know, these politicians, and this is probably a segue into the Syria thing, but these politicians are run scared of the Israel lobby because they know if they do something that the Israel lobby doesn't like, their opponent is going to get a whole lot of money and they're going to get very bad press coverage and everything like that. So it's a very powerful group. We have to understand that. And yet this is a group that we can't talk about. We're not supposed to talk about their power. We're supposed to say, well, they don't really have any influence or they're on both sides of every question. Not the case. It's definitely not the case.
Yes, I agree. Gilad Atzmon, he's actually an Israeli guy who denounced his Israeli citizenship and his ethnic Jewish identity. He describes Jewish power as the ability to shut down any discussion of Jewish power. And I think that's very, I think that's very well said. Yeah, because these are issues you just cannot talk about. And I mean, again, it does demonstrate their power. I mean, there's that old saying, to learn who rules over you, find out who you're not allowed to criticize.
Exactly.
And I mean, Jews so truly are the one group of people you are not allowed to openly criticize. Yeah. At least they're the main ones. You know what I mean? And, you know, I think the main thing is, and this is a point that I made, I wrote a blog post about the whole Syria situation and how Bolton was literally coordinating with Netanyahu and the Israeli government to, you know, come up with this strike on Syria. And it kind of goes to your broader point that, you know, we really are facing a situation where Jewish narratives of history and current events and Jewish interests really dictate everything that we do, everything that our government does, everything that our media does, by and large anyways. I mean, that is really the reality of the situation. And yeah. I think, you know, it's you know, I'm sort of putting it in very kind of simplistic terms that, you know, a guy like Kaufness would probably scoff at, you know, oh, this guy's just, you know, some rube that is just making these very overgeneralized statements. But really, that is what we're facing. I mean, on pretty much any issue of major importance, you know, you mentioned immigration. I mean, think about what Trump was saying. He's just basically saying we need to enforce our law. And, you know, the whole world is attacking him as this racist, as this, you know, guy that wants to, you know, kick out Mexicans and Muslims, etc. It's just insane how powerful their control of the narrative is, and any deviation from it is met with hostility and vitriol, and you know, you're going to be attacked and undermined. It's really incredible. But that is the situation we are facing right now.
Yeah.
And it's been that way for a very long time. I mean, again, your book explains the historical nature of this and how they've kind of come to this, you know, how we find ourselves now, where like their ideas are literally institutionalized across our government, across virtually every aspect of our society.
That's been the amazing thing about the Syria situation. Somebody put out a tweet that there were something like 40 tweets over around 2011 to 2013 from Trump, and Trump's repeated statements during the campaign, no foreign interventions and all that. So all these tweets from 2011 to 2013 opposing any intervention in Syria, saying it's a bad idea, and all that. So this is a guy who has the right instincts. He gets it. But what happens when he gets to be president? You have this overwhelming consensus within the security people. And then for some reason, he hires John Bolton. I just don't understand that. I don't know where he's going or why he's doing this. But it makes no sense. And yet, I think, you know, he's getting better press now for that. I mean, you don't see liberals complaining about it, really, very tepidly a little bit, because it's the same, you know, these politicians, it's the same kind of problem. They know Israel's entirely on board with it. Netanyahu officially approved the strike, said it was a great idea. Now he's saying we should do the same thing with Iran. Because, you know, they've got nuclear weapons. We've got to prevent that in the same way we've got to prevent Syria from having chemical weapons. And they get it. They understand that this is how it works in Washington. And they will suffer consequences if they don't do it. But I'm really disappointed in Trump doing this. He's gone against his own beliefs. his own gut instincts.
Mm-hmm.
And
once again, yep.
Just once again, it's just ridiculous. So this is something that started with Obama, you know, 2011. Since then, there's 500,000 Syrians have died, 10 million displaced. Absolutely no benefit. There's, it's just going on and on and on. All we're doing is prolonging this thing. Assad is in charge. Russia has made it very clear they're not going to allow Assad to be deposed. And what are we doing? It's just nuts.
It's shameful. It's absolutely disgraceful how this all went down. And it's, it's very similar to the last strike, which took place a little over a year ago. It was in April of 2017. In fact, it was the last time you were on the program, which I'll have a link to that discussion for anybody that wants to go back and listen to that, because it really was almost the same exact situation. This time, though, what's interesting is that I think it was like roughly 1 week before the alleged chemical attack, which from what I can tell was a total media created fabrication. It didn't even happen. They've been known for, you know, faking these events in the media and then presenting it as, you know, a chemical attack, which sounds like was the same exact thing that happened 1 year ago. And yet here's Trump. You know, Trump is going on and on about the fake news media, yet he buys this hook, line, and sinker. No evidence needed to support it. In fact, the U.S. government hasn't been able to demonstrate this happened at all. They're just, right. you know, citing, you know, social media posts and open source intelligence and, you know, classified information that they can't discuss. It really is insulting. They're just, you know, basically saying they're going to do whatever the hell they want without any proof or evidence to demonstrate any of this is actually happening. But
that's what's amazing. I mean, yeah. That even after 1 year, they haven't been able to show that the attack in 2017 was done by Assad. The Defense Department says this. Mattis says this. The Secretary of Defense. Why in the world are we doing this again? It's just like, you know, fool me once, you know, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. This is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And all it's doing is continuing the destabilization of Syria, which is exactly what Israel wants. And it's just at an enormous cost to the United States in terms of money, our commitment over $6 trillion. Do you realize what we could have done with $6 trillion in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria? It's just mind-boggling to think about it.
Yes, and I'm over here on my Twitter feed. I'm trying to find an article I tweeted that came from the Jewish Telegraph Agency, and it was an article about how, and Trump did announce that he wanted to withdraw from Syria roughly 1 week before this all happened. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Yeah. Trump was out
there. 2 days later, we get this attack. Oh.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. That's the thing. It's like, they must just think we're all a bunch of just total idiots that are not paying attention. And sadly, a lot of us are, but it's insulting. I mean, here Trump is saying he wants to get out of Syria. The article that I'm trying to find right now talked about how Netanyahu and the Israeli government were very much against that. And they didn't want, you know, America to withdraw from Syria, etc. And then, oh, what do you know? It just so happens, you know, Assad starts using chemical weapons again, giving the United States justification to go in there and bomb them. It's insane. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Here it is right here. This is from April 3rd. Donald Trump wants out of Syria. Israel thinks that's a problem. That's the title of the article.
I remember that one.
And this is, again, this is April 3rd.
Yeah.
I think the alleged attack happened that Saturday, the 7th, so a few days later. And then we launch airstrikes, I think it was Friday, just this past Friday night. So,
yeah.
I mean, you know, it's you'd have to be very, very clueless not to, you know, kind of connect the dots and kind of figure out what's going on here. And again, this idea that Assad is launching these chemical weapons attacks is just insulting. It's just as bad as, you know, Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. I mean, it's just childish. It's insane. And yet, you know, the whole media is saying the same thing. And of course, all these politicians are going along with it. At least most of them. I've seen a few dissenting ones, including the, I don't know if she's a senator. I think she's actually a congresswoman from Hawaii. She's been very principled and very anti-war. She's a Democratic lady. But at least, you know, she's kind of telling the truth about this whole Syria situation. I'm going to see if I can find her name. I can't recall it off the top of my head. But anyways, my point is that pretty much the entire political establishment, the Republicans and the Democrats, are supporting Trump in this. You know, the Democrats are always going on and trying to undermine Trump and attack Trump. And yet, you know, of course, they go along with this strike over in Syria.
Yeah, I mean, you think about it, this started in 2011 under Obama. Democrats didn't complain about that at all. And if Hillary got to be president, you can bet that this would have happened a long time ago. We'd be worse. We'd be more involved in Syria than we are now. And Democrats would have loved it. You know, it's just partisan politics. So yeah, they've had some tepid criticisms of this, but no real. You see the way they talk about Trump in other contexts, and it's absolutely vicious. And with this one, it's like, well, you know, he didn't really have authorization from Congress, as if that ever matters anymore.
By the way, the woman, her name is Tulsi Gabbard. She's the congresswoman from Hawaii. She's been very, and she's always kind of been an anti-war type, very principled individual. So there are people like that who are out there exposing this stuff. I saw you had retweeted some gentleman on MSNBC, I think, where he was kind of explaining how ridiculous the whole Syria situation was this morning. So there are people, I guess, in the mainstream saying these things, but our government certainly is, you know, going along with this totally neocon, totally Jewish, totally, you know, Israeli agenda in the Middle East. And it's very sad. It's very, it's the total opposite of everything that Donald Trump said and ran on his whole candidacy. It's the total opposite of it.
Yeah, what's amazing is that the big, you know, liberal media like New York Times, Washington Post, they're giving them a complete pass on this too. You know, and it's astonishing. They don't need proof. You really wonder what's going on. It's the same thing, of course, that happened with the Iraq War, where, you know, they at least they claimed to have proof. Turned out it was completely false. Here, you know, there's not even you don't even need proof anymore.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. Yeah, I mean, back then they at least went out in front of the UN and, you know, had some slideshows to go through, at least. You know, I mean, it was ridiculous, but at least they had something. Now they're just openly saying, look, we don't have to show you any evidence or proof. This is what we're doing.
Yeah. With the Iraq War, you had all these very dedicated Jews in the Department of Defense who are, you know, cooking up this intelligence or cherry picking data to provide for President Bush at the time. And it was completely fraudulent. These guys were totally, they're neocons, they're working under Paul Wolfowitz. This was just a complete Israeli fifth column operation here. And it got us into the Iraq War, which is the beginning of all the really bad stuff that's happened. You talk about, you know, the trillions of dollars, the thousands and thousands of American lives, the hundreds of thousands of Middle Eastern or Iraqis, Syrians, and so on. This is the thing that really started it. And talk about a huge strategic blunder. Even for them, you take down Saddam, who's a stalwart against Iran. They just had a war not that long ago. They come from different parts of the Muslim religion, the Sunni and the Shiite. And, you know, you get rid of Saddam, and now you have the Shiite crescent, as they say, from Iran all the way into Lebanon. And that's now is a much more powerful bloc potentially. And so they're continuing to destabilize it. It makes sense from their point of view, I guess, that because the situation is certainly far from stable. And now today, it looks like Israel has actually said, you know, Netanyahu, that they want to pursue the same policy towards Iran that Trump pursued towards Syria. That is preemptive bombing, bombing these sites. Instead of chemical weapons, they wanted to bomb the sites where there are, you know, atomic, you know, nuclear weapons. And we're going to go down the same path. And so the next big target for these people is Iran. Watch out. Bolton wants Iran. And very sad. I just don't.
Yeah. It is sad. And it's, you know, you're totally right. It's all part of this same Zionist agenda in the Middle East that goes back to 9/11. I mean, they were openly writing about how they needed a new Pearl Harbor, right? I mean, that's a direct quote from the PNAC document, the Project for a New American Century. And there were a variety of other think tanks, many of whom were staffed by dual citizens and other, you know, Zionist hardliners. And a lot of them were working with the Israelis. And they were cooking up this narrative of a global war on terrorism. They wanted to basically use the American military and I guess, you know, her Western allies, you know, NATO in general, to basically destroy all of the sovereign nation states in the Middle East surrounding Israel, paving the way for Israeli domination of the region. And that's exactly what's happened. I mean, that is literally exactly what's happened. And it's ongoing, right? I mean, they did Iraq. You know, they have targeted and struck Iran in the past, Libya. I mean, it goes on and on. I mean, what country in the Middle East hasn't been targeted by the United States at the behest of the Jews and the Israelis? You know, I mean, pretty much everyone has. And
except Jordan and Egypt, I guess. I don't know offhand, but it's
right.
Pathetic.
Yeah, and it's very clear. You know, they're not making this a secret. You know, they've openly wrote about this and spoke about this. You know, this is what their agenda is, and this is what they're doing. And sadly, all of our politicians, Democrats and Republicans alike, go along with it. You know, it's
incredible. Disgraceful. If you go back even to the 1980s, you look at Israeli foreign policy experts, they were talking about the fact that these Arab states are kind of fragile, that there are a lot of different factions. And so it's not that difficult to produce a civil war inside an Arab society. There's always, you know, all these different ethnic groups and so on. Like, so you got Kurds in Syria and you've got, you know, you've got Sunni, you know, in Shiite areas and so on, and like in Iraq. So you can always pit them against each other. And they've been very successful at doing that. And that's sort of the game plan there. I don't think Iran is capable of, I think they're more unified than some of these countries. I don't think they can do that there, but. They've been very successful. That's what happened in Libya. You attack Muammar Gaddafi and you just produce a civil war between factions within Libya. And so it's still destabilized to this day. And now you've got slavery there and just an absolute economic disaster. It's amazing. And they keep spouting this idealism. We must topple, we must have regime change to produce democracy and freedom for these countries. And it never, ever works. And yet they keep doing it. So you, at some point you realize it's not idealism, it's cynicism. And they're doing it for very real interests that have nothing to do with higher, you know, more moral sentiments.
Yes, exactly. And another aspect of all of this is, you know, we're going over and intervening and in some cases outright invading some of these countries like Iraq, like Libya. In other cases, like in Syria, we're coordinating with and training and funding some of these jihadi groups that are, you know, basically outright terrorist organizations. And we're using these, you know, proxy armies to attempt to overthrow the government. That's going on in Syria. It's going on in other countries as well. And what gets lost in all this is the displacement of people. You know, people are getting killed left and right. People are being displaced. And where are they going to go? They're going to go to Europe. I mean, it's causing this refugee crisis where all these people are flooding into Europe. It's just a total disaster any way you look at it. And the most common sense thing to do would be just to get out of the region and stop this madness. And yet that's pretty much the exact opposite of what we're doing, sadly.
Sadly, it is. Yeah, these different rebel groups, there's a lot of different groups in Syria. And again, those societies are very fractionated. ISIS is there. But to suppose that any of these groups really want anything like a sort of democratic, republican kind of constitutional society, like the United States or Western Europe, is complete fantasy. These people, when they got in power, they're going to be as dictatorial. They're going to favor their own. The Christians there are probably going to get wiped out. Certainly Assad's group, his ethnic group, would get wiped out. So it's completely, I got to figure it's deception at this point. They know darn well that those groups are not, what they sometimes say they are. They're, dictatorial. They would set up a tyranny within Syria and get rid of their enemies.
Absolutely. You know, what struck me in following all of this the past couple days is watching and reading what the Russians and what the Syrians are saying, and it's such a stark contrast. You know, watching, for example, Putin or any of the representatives of the Russian government talk to the media, speak at the UN, same thing with Syria. These people are very righteous and telling the truth and basically making a lot of the points that we're making, right? And it's such a stark contrast, that this is what I wish our government would be like. I wish we had people that were telling the truth and standing up for what's right. And yet we see the Russians doing it, we see the Syrians doing it, and then our government is absolutely despicable, disgraceful. I watched Nikki Haley at the UN. This woman is a monster. I mean, so disrespectful, so arrogant. They got up and walked out as the Syrian ambassador is trying to speak and make his case. It's absolutely despicable.
Bill Kristol put out a tweet or an article or something. He wants Mike Pompeo and Nikki Haley to be the presidential ticket for Republicans in 2020, which would mean that Trump is gone by then. But, Mike Pompeo is another one. He has a history of being very much on the neocon side, and they love Nikki Haley. She's right up there with John Bolton, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, these people haven't seen a war that they didn't like, they didn't want to pursue. I mean, they're just absolutely crazy. And to think that this is our top diplomat, representing us at the UN, representing us, in the international community, it's disgraceful. It makes me ashamed to be an American, and to think that
ambitious, she knows what has to be done. Well, you look at someone like Senator Warren, Elizabeth Warren, she's a liberal. You think her instincts would be against war. She has said nothing against this kind of thing. She said nothing about, our policy in the Middle East. That's all critical of intervention and war. These people, if they want higher office, I think that the senator from Hawaii that you're talking about, she probably does not aspire to that. But if you really want to get up there and in the big league of American politics, you better toe the line. And that's what happens. Nancy Pelosi had very tepid criticism. Of Trump on this. Contrast that to the vicious criticism on everything else, on Russian collusion and God knows what all that they go after.
Yep, exactly. I mean, and it kind of goes back to the point I was making, how Jewish and Israeli narratives and interests, I mean, it's institutionalized in America. We put what they want first. And it's very obvious. It's often very explicit. They're openly saying this. I was watching a clip from Tucker Carlson where he had, who was that? It was a senator. I can't think off the top of my head. But
yeah,
I mean,
that.
He basically admits, well, don't you care about Israel? Like, that was his first argument for supporting the strike in Syria. And it shows you, these people are just openly saying these things. Like, we're openly putting Israel's interests ahead of America's. It's that obvious, right?
It's that obvious. Tucker Carlson has been really good. I mean, he was the only talking head that I know of, big time talking head on the big news networks that was very, very much opposed to this. And in general, he gets it. I mean, There's not a big difference between you and me, you and me, versus Tucker Carlson. He's really on board. He talks about immigration things a lot, and in a very, very similar way that we would. He doesn't really bring up race, but he definitely is on board with pretty much everything we'd want. And this was no exception. He was just very articulate on his show in opposing this, but didn't have any effect, unfortunately.
Yeah. I saw his monologue, and I don't watch his show regularly, but I do catch clips of it on YouTube, and he is very impressive. I'm glad that he has that kind of primetime spot on Fox News.
Yeah.
Which is good, yeah, because he is a very good critic. And Ann Coulter is also very impressive.
She is.
You know, these are sort of mainstream figures that are speaking the truth in a lot of ways. I mean, they're not really explaining things how maybe you or I would, but at least they're bringing up a lot of these basic points.
That's right. Ann Coulter's been good on the Syria thing, and Tucker. Yeah, the voices are out there, but we're still, still don't see that big breakthrough. But
yeah, you know what? I'm wondering when people like Anne and Tucker Carlson are going to really go all the way and connect all the dots and start, you know, calling out the Israelis and the organized Jewish community, in the United States for being behind a lot of this. You know, that's really what we need, is we need somebody out there openly saying these things and stop being so afraid of the Jews, right? I mean, that's what this boils down to. And for so long, you know, people have just been so intimidated, so really oppressed by these people.
Yeah, I think that Tucker Carlson really, if we were getting a room all alone and it could never get out that we were together or talk, I think we would agree 100% on everything. But he knows what he can and can't say. Same with Ann Coulter. And that's sad. I mean, that's the thing. As we just said a while ago, you know, if you want to know who's really powerful, you know, find out who you can't criticize. That's really what it comes down to. But at least they're implicitly saying that, and it's important to get those messages out. I mean, for example, Tucker Carlson will talk about the social cohesion, that immigration destroys the cohesion of neighborhoods and people. And he's, you know, why should people want this? I mean, it's not in their interest. These communities have changed before their very eyes, and not in a beneficial way, that any way that's beneficial to them. And so, you know, what's the problem with that? But he won't talk about, you know, the sort of deeper forces at work here and what they want, the kind of America they want. But it's a step in the right direction anyway.
Yeah,
and
by the way, I think so.
On his show, he actually replaced Bill O'Reilly. Thank God. Bill O'Reilly, for example, came out very much endorsing Trump's Syrian attack. And he's such a middle of the road kind of guy, you know, trying to be a nice guy, conservative all the time. So Tucker Carlson's a huge improvement on that.
Yes, I agree. And I think it's good, you know, the way they're pushing the political discourse more in an alt-right race realist direction is good. And, you know, getting back to Koufness and this guy, Abraham Miller, who you said he was actually a professor. I'm sorry. I called him a journalist. He's actually a professor of political science. You know, he wrote that op-ed in the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
It's good that, I mean, at least the mainstream, you know, these Jewish academics and journalists and whatnot, they're at least being forced to address our points. And it really kind of proves how just fallacious their arguments are and how unconvincing they are. You know what I mean? And really kind of childish, a lot of them. They're not really dealing with your main points and your primary thesis. They're not really undermining it at all. They're just kind of cherry picking. And see, that's the thing that Koufness argues. He argues that you're misrepresenting sources and cherry picking facts to support your ideas and conclusions, when I think you can make a case that that's kind of what he's doing.
Well, that's what I did make a case. That's exactly what he's doing. I especially in my second comment, I called out a whole bunch of misrepresentations in his comments. And I did that sometimes in my first reply to him. But yeah, there's a lot of misrepresentations going on. As far as Miller's concerned, his main argument is that other these other groups, you know, the Catholics and other Protestant religious sects were also in favor of this law. Well, if you look at it historically, Jewish pro-immigration groups funded these Protestant organizations and did all the work and everything else for them. And so these organizations were not at all, you know, opposed to the restrictive laws in 1952, in 1924. And, it really was once Lyndon Johnson got in and they had a big majority in Congress, that really changed things. And, it wasn't long before they went after this, which had been a 40-year crusade by the Jewish community. You look at the historical documents, everybody sort of understood. Everybody understood in Congress where this is coming from. And it would often be referred to. They would talk about professional Jews. You know, senators and congressmen would talk about professional Jews involved in this and Jewish organizations. And you'd have these Jewish spokesmen. It was very much a Jewish project. But in 1965, it happened. And ever since then, they've been bucking up the numbers. That's all they had to do. After 1965 itself didn't change this country. And they promised it wouldn't change the country. But then after that, once you got rid of national origins, then immigration could come from anywhere. And what they did after that was to simply increase the number. So now it's over 1 million a year counting.
It's insane that many people coming into our country every single year. Yeah. You know, and one point I wanted to bring up as well is Koufness was arguing that, you know, again, there were other non-Jews involved in passing this. But correct me if I'm wrong, weren't a lot of the people that, you know, sort of acquiesced or eventually went along with passing the bill, they did so under they supported the bill under the assumption that it wouldn't drastically change the you know, the ethnic demographic of America. Is that right?
Exactly. And in fact, Abraham Miller mentions that in his op-ed. He says that this congressman from Ohio, Fagan, had actually finally signed on to the bill. This is a guy who would oppose any change in the national origins form from all the time he'd been in Congress, like over 20 years or something. But he finally went along with it on the assumption that it would not change the ethnic balance of the country. And so he actually went for family-based immigration. This had been Jewish policy forever. Jews had never, in the 1940s, you had all these Jewish spokesmen saying things like, we should not have a Taylor immigration policy for the good of the United States. We should do it for the good of the people we're bringing in, you know. It should not be self-interested. It should be family-based. And so that became the basis of our foreign policy, of our immigration policy. But this guy Fagan was completely, Teddy Kennedy was promising, this will not change the ethnic balance. It won't. It's window dressing. We're trying to show we're nice people now. We're not going to favor our own and bring people preferentially from Western Europe. We're going to, open it up to everybody in the world, but we're not going to increase the numbers. So, it's not going to really change the ethnic balance of the country. Well, once they got that law, obviously all they had to do was increase the numbers. And that's what happened in subsequent years. And Jewish organizations were, I found it very interesting because there was an article in this Jewish yearbook that I cite in chapter 7, 1965. As soon as the law was passed, that they were saying all the Jewish activism was then directed at increasing numbers. And that's exactly what happened. All they had to do was get rid of the principle of national origins, and everything else fell in place.
Yep, it kind of opened the floodgates for sure.
Yeah.
I'd like for you to address what Koufness calls his default hypothesis, where I think he's basically saying that a lot of you can explain a lot of this by the fact that Jews have a high IQ and that they have access to or they live in urban areas. Did you you want to address that at all?
I didn't find it
very convincing. And, yeah, go ahead.
Exactly. The Jews are smart, and so they're involved in intellectual movements. But again, what I talk about are specific movements, and I want to see where the power is. So the fact that you have some Jews who disagree with it, or the Jews tend to be involved in other intellectual movements. For example, one thing I bring up in the second reply is populism. He pointed out that some pro-Trump Jews, you think of Trump as a populist, or a better example is Paul Gottfried, very clear example. Paul Gottfried is a paleoconservative. Okay. And you could bring that up and say, if you look at, and Kaufman did bring that up, if you look at prominent, paleoconservative figures, you'll see someone like Gottfried, and they will constitute more than 2 or 3% of paleoconservative intellectuals. But my point is, that's not important. What's important is that these neocons actually destroyed the paleocons. They took them out of power, and that paleoconservatives is by no stretch a Jewish movement. In other words, Paul Gottfried is a minority in terms of Jewish, non-Jewish, in the paleoconservative movement. He's one of maybe 10 prominent intellectuals or something like that. So that's 10%. It's not, and the people doing this are not strongly identified Jews. They don't see this as advancing Jewish interests. Now, maybe Gottfried does, but the rest of them certainly don't. This is not, no one would say populism or paleoconservatism were Jewish movements. So what I focus on is where the power is, where the specific movements in the social sciences that did have this Jewish backbone, Jewish motivations, and eventually became very powerful. If you look at neocons versus paleocons, the paleocons were basically ousted from power during the Reagan administration, and by the time of the Bush II administration, they were in charge of foreign policy in the Republican Party. And that's why we had the Iraq War. What was important here? The paleocons, they were out of power. You had Pat Buchanan, right? Pat Buchanan, very important guy. But he's not Jewish, and he does not participate in a Jewish intellectual movement, and Jews hate him. He's said things about the Holocaust they don't like. So where's the power? It's not with Buchanan. It was with the neocons, Bill Kristol, Weekly Standard, all those people in the Bush administration, Wolfowitz, et cetera. Those are the ones that are wielding the power. So Kaufman is right in the sense that that someone like Gottfried represents more than 2 or 3% of the paleocon intellectuals, but paleoconservative is not a Jewish intellectual movement. And really, it was destroyed by a Jewish intellectual movement, which is neoconservatism. There's no question. And again, that was a chapter that should have been in Culture Critique. I've since written it, and it's going to be included in expanded versions of Culture Critique. Neoconservatism is a Jewish movement. And really, people understand that. Historians looking at a neoconservative will basically say that. It was always about Israel, really. And in general, these neoconservatives had stronger Jewish identity, a stronger sense of pursuing Jewish interests than Jews on the left. They see Israel as fundamental to Jewish interests, and they have pursued those interests to the hilt within the American political establishment.
Yes, indeed. Ooh, I'm getting some feedback every time I start talking. Anyways, no, I think you're right. And I think, people can go read Kaufness's work and see for themselves if he, debunks any of your main points. I frankly don't think he does at all. And again, I think it's clear that the work that you did, the three books that you wrote, you kind of outlined the historical basis, how these individuals and these groups were fundamentally influenced by their Jewish identity, and how they were determined to advance policies and ideas that ultimately undermined traditional Western civilization, because they viewed it as a conflict. They viewed it as a conflict between Jews and non-Jews. and they wanted to make America, you know, ripe for Jewish exploitation. And that's exactly what they've done. We see it today. That's the main thing that I would bring up is you can basically show that everything you wrote in your book is still going on today simply by just looking at what these Jewish organizations are openly telling us they're doing. Yeah. You know what I mean? And I wouldn't necessarily
use the word exploitation, but just that Jews have fashioned America to serve their own interests. And one of those interests is supporting Israel. And so you have a foreign policy establishment that is utterly infiltrated and really dominated by the Israel lobby. That's a great example about our immigration policy and really globalism in general. Jews tend to be international. By the way, Orban in Hungary had a great speech the other day where he's talking about these international people that have no national ties. And he's clearly referring in a sort of implicit way to Jews, but they don't identify with the nation state that they're in, and except Israel. Well, he didn't say that, but that you have this sort of globalist mentality that borders really are artificial, that we should have free trade, free movement of people. They should go anywhere, be able to go anywhere they want. And that's their agenda. And that's not in our interest, believe me.
Exactly.
There are going to be 4 billion Africans by the end of the century, and they ain't going to want to all stay in Africa. They're going to want to flood these other countries. We cannot let that happen. We've already let it happen way too much.
Yes, very well said. I completely agree with you. And Dr. McDonald, we are getting to the hour mark. I said I'd keep you here for about an hour. I think we had a good discussion. Yeah, the Syria situation, you know, I'm at a loss for words anymore with what to say. It's like the same thing over and over again with any of this stuff, and it's very frustrating. It's very unfortunate. You know, I guess we got to just keep putting the pressure on him. Although I don't know if it's gonna matter all that much, sadly. But it's to me, it's becoming crystal clear what's going on. And if you don't see it, then something is wrong with you. Your mind has been poisoned by this Jewish propaganda, or you're just simply not paying attention. And it's outrageous what's going on. It's sad. Again, it makes me ashamed to be an American that we're sitting here, you know, launching missile strikes based on totally fake news, demonstrably fake news. I mean, insulting fake news. And, you know, we're supposed to go along with this? No way. It's it's outrageous, man.
It's outrageous. Obviously, the alt-right is needed more than ever. We're the only really identifiable group that understands all this and is willing to pursue an America First policy in every way, whether it's immigration or trade or our foreign policy. And that's just that's the reality.
That's right. Well, I think you're doing good work, and I would encourage people
to... You are too, buddy.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I would encourage people to check out your website. It's theoccidentalobserver.net. And then you also publish the Occidental Quarterly, correct? Is that still being published?
Yes, it is being published. And I really appreciate it if people would make an effort to subscribe to that. It costs $30 a year for the online version, $60 a year for the print version. But we've been hurt by PayPal, you know, ending us, and so our subscriptions are down right now. But I it's a very worthwhile journal, something that people can support without really breaking the bank at all, and really helping us out because we want to be self-sufficient. We're not self-sufficient at this point, and so that's something that people could really do. Occidental Quarterly, TOQ Online.
Very good. Yes, I will have a link over there as well, and people can subscribe and support your work. And I would, again, encourage them to do just that.
Yeah.
So, Dr. McDonald, thank you very much. Thanks for coming
Thanks
on
a lot,
and
John.
Taking the time. Yes, I will talk to
we'll
you.
We'll do
very
it
soon.
Again.
Okay, sounds good. Okay. Thank you.